Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, it is hard to say precisely how a press corps should report on a president's all-caps threat to another country's president about their demented words of violence and death. There are a lot of ways to go. But in addressing Donald Trump's virulent threats to the president of Iran, media have minimally the responsibility to separate accusation from reality. And then, one would hope, to talk openly about how to resist the degeneration of diplomacy and the rise of almost hysterically bellicose language that seems like greasing the tracks toward war. We'll talk about the current state of U.S.-Iran relations with Trita Parsi, founder and president of the National Iranian American Council. Also on the show, local newspapers have been facing death by a thousand cuts for decades now. Each time another venerable daily shuts its doors, or as in the case of New York's Daily News, fires half its editorial staff after a one-minute meeting, there is a spate of stories wondering what the loss means, and often leaving the impression that it's a matter of feeling. Did you like the paper? Do you feel guilty because you stopped buying it? New research takes a very hard-headed look at some of the costs involved when a community loses a local paper. Dermot Murphy is assistant professor of finance at the University of Illinois at Chicago. He'll join us to talk about the report, Financing Dies in Darkness. That's coming up, but first a quick look back at recent press. You may have seen the headlines. Study: Medicare for All projected to cost $32.6 trillion, said ABC News. CBS News elaborated, study: Medicare for All plan touted by Bernie Sanders would cost $32.6 trillion. Medicare for All, a federally funded universal health care plan championed by Senator Bernie Sanders and others, has become a key issue for progressive voters evaluating Democratic Party candidates for the 2008 midterms and the 2020 presidential race. The plan would provide coverage for the 40 million currently uninsured in the U.S., a gap that's estimated to cause tens of thousands of deaths annually. But, as Justin Anderson reports for Fair.org, it has received no shortage of negative coverage in the media, all revolving around a question unasked in other contexts: how are we going to pay for it? It's in this atmosphere that a new study emerges from Charles Blahaus at the libertarian-leaning Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Blahaus's study projected that Sanders' Medicare for All system, assuming it was enacted in 2022, would cost the federal government $32.6 trillion in excess spending over the course of 10 years. And, as noted, it wasn't just conservative media that leapt on that scary-sounding number. But whether at the National Review or Time magazine, the headlines missed a central point in Blahaus's study. In terms of total federal, state, and private spending on health care, the Medicare for All plan is projected to cost trillions less than projections of spending under the current U.S. health care system. True, a cursory glance at Blahaus's study wouldn't show that. He obscured his own findings by not displaying the 10-year totals for Medicare for All cost savings in his tables. As Matt Brunig, head of the People's Policy Project, pointed out in Jacobin, adding up all the values for Medicare for All savings from 2022 to 2031 in Table 2 of Blahaus's study shows that enacting the plan would save $2.1 trillion in national health expenditures over that period. It's as if Blahaus saw the results of his data and didn't like them, so he just decided not to publicize them in his table. And outlets like Axios followed his lead. The site's write-up contained the following at the bottom of its worth noting section. Quote, all told, Medicare for All would actually slightly reduce the total amount we pay for health care, but the plan would increase the share of that cost paid through taxes rather than through insurance premiums or out-of-pocket. Close quote. And there's the rub. Medicare for All would amount to net savings on overall health care spending, besides the evidently ancillary matter of guaranteeing health care coverage for every American. But the Mercatus Center, funded primarily by conservative billionaires Charles and David Koch, And all the publications making a fuss are much more interested in the conservative boogeyman, taxes. In AP's report, Emory professor and former Clinton advisor Kenneth Thorpe notes pointedly, quote, "There are going to be a lot of people who'll pay more in taxes than they save on premiums," close quote. Those people will certainly be at the top end of the income scale and not the ones currently deciding between going to the doctor and paying the rent. Some publications, largely but not entirely progressive ones, including Common Dreams, Vox, Business Insider, and Vice, did not naively parrot the Mercatus study's price tag. They pointed out the large cost savings of Medicare for All implicit in the study's findings and the benefits of universal health care coverage from an ethical as well as an economic perspective. But the fact that a single study by a think tank with an anti-tax agenda could so easily frame news coverage on health care shows just how powerful the myth of fiscal responsibility can be. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. August 5th marks the anniversary of the Gulf of Tonkin incident, when journalists reported official claims about an unprovoked attack by North Vietnam on American destroyers as absolute truths, ignoring countervailing evidence and opening the floodgates for the bloody escalation of the war and the deaths of millions of Southeast Asians and over 50,000 Americans. The Johnson administration was able to use media and their credulity when it comes to official enemies to put through a plan they intended anyway. Donald Trump is not obscuring, successfully, that he wants what is blithely referred to as regime change in Iran, and media aren't really hiding that drive either. But is that the same thing as challenging it or interrogating the premises the White House is lining up? The talk of Iran's malign behavior, support for terrorists, pursuit of nuclear weapons, its mistreatment of its own people, and all of that. Joining us now to talk about how to get off what feels like a path to war with Iran is Trita Parsi, founder and president of the National Iranian American Council, and author of, most recently, Losing an Enemy: Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. He joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Trita Parsi.
Thank you so much.
Well, today's reports have it that Donald Trump says he is willing to meet with Iran's leadership without preconditions whenever they want. That's a week after tweet threatening Iran's president Hassan Rouhani with consequences the likes of which few throughout history have ever suffered before. CNN called Trump's recent statement an abrupt shift in tone. That misses the fact that abrupt shifts in tone are Trump's tone. But they also called the offer of a meeting an olive branch. How appropriate a depiction is that, to your mind, of the present moment?
I think it would be quite inaccurate to call it an olive branch. At the end of the day, even if one were to accept it to be a genuine offer, and I think that's a question mark in and of itself, just the offer of having conversations while the actual policy is to escalate tensions, is to escalate economic pressure, is hardly an olive branch. An olive branch should at least bring forward some element of substance, and there was no such thing in anything that Trump has put on the table thus far.
Well, because Trump is Trump, there's room to say maybe he doesn't really mean it in Iran. Maybe it's a shiny object. What are the indicators that this administration truly intends, if not war, the sort of capitulation that is the goal of war?
Well, I think the problem is that this administration is not pursuing one foreign policy. It's pursuing five or six simultaneous foreign policies. So I think there is enough data out there to be able to say that, you know what, perhaps Trump actually is serious. He would at least like to have a deal with the Iranians. The idea of him having his name on the deal and the idea of him being able to say that it was a better deal than that of the previous administration certainly is attractive to him. But is that consistent with the approach that is being pursued by John Bolton and by Pompeo, et cetera, and the many actual things that are taking place right now in the manner in which the Trump administration is really undermining the Iranian economy? Reuters have reported that U.S. officials have said that their objective is to foment unrest in Iran, and we are seeing unrest in Iran. So mindful of the fact that this is an administration that has several simultaneous foreign policies, it makes it very difficult to be able to determine which one is the one that actually counts.
Right, right. Well, every time I hear that Trump or the United States are deeply concerned or primarily concerned with Iran's mistreatment of its own people, I sort of can't believe it's being reported without a laugh track. But you just talked about actual effects inside Iran, even if it sounds like it's just rhetoric or it's just saber rattling. Trump is, there are actions here and they're having an effect inside Iran. What have been some of the effects within Iran of Trump's words and actions?
Well, even from the very moment he came into office, he has been undermining the nuclear deal and creating so much uncertainty as to whether it would survive or not, that even before he actually pulled out of the deal, he was in violation of the deal, and he was making sure that European and other businesses were either not going into the market or starting to get out of the Iranian market. And part of the reason why this is important is because a big part of the nuclear deal was that the Iranians would agree to restrictions to their nuclear program in return for sanctions relief. Trump was undermining and sabotaging the sanctions relief. In fact, the uncertainty that he injected into the atmosphere was in and of itself a de facto sanction. And that has contributed. It's not the sole cause, but it certainly has been a major cause as to why the Iranian economy is doing as badly as it is right now. There is very likely some form of currency manipulation taking place as well that is causing the Iranian currency to drop at a very fast pace right now. And these are all part of the policy of pressuring the Iranians in the hope that they will capitulate. I doubt that they will. I don't see panic in the Iranian government at this point, although the people are really, really suffering from the combination of Trump's sanctions and sabotage of the nuclear deal, Iranian government's own mismanagement and corruption in the economy, as well as the political repression that has taken place there.
Well, and then for people who are interested in supporting civil society or supporting moderate factions within Iran, what has been the impact in, politically in that sense?
Well, if you want to drive things towards a confrontation or even a regime change policy, one of the first things you will do is to deny that there is such a thing as moderates of Iran. You will make the argument that there is no difference between Rouhani and Ahmadinejad, for instance, which I think is a preposterous statement. But that is exactly the things that John Bolton and Pompeo have been saying. And I think it's quite clear that their preference is much more of a confrontation with Iran, whether it is a military one or whether it is regime destabilization or regime change, and that Trump is toying with the idea, at least, of having some form of a summit with Iranians. He seems to have fallen in love with the idea of doing summits. But these are contradictory policies, and I think it is causing a lot of confusion in Iran. They don't know which policy actually is the policy and whether Trump even is capable of steering this ship and not be undermined by his own cabinet members.
On Democracy Now! Back in May, you said Pompeo and Bolton have made the choice for the international community much, much easier. Either you collaborate with the Trump administration and go along with these sanctions, walk away from this nuclear deal and speed up this march toward war, or you resist. What does that resistance look like?
Well, first of all, I think there needs to be much stronger of a public and an international outcry against the effort of undermining the nuclear deal. Now, clearly the Europeans and others have spoken out. They're trying to do whatever they can to make sure that the deal survives. But I think more should be done and more is needed to be done, because at the end of the day, if there is some form of a confrontation between the United States and Iran, the devastating effects will be of a completely different magnitude than the devastating effects of the Iraq War. And we are now 17 years after the Iraq War, still 16 years, still feeling the very negative repercussions of that, both in the U.S. as well as in the region.
Well, I fear, as I sort of indicated, that media can editorially reject the kind of big picture, the idea of war, even the idea of pulling out of the nuclear agreement, which most major media in this country did oppose that, and still somehow not root out these underlying myths like Iran's ceaseless and vigorous pursuit of nuclear weapons, for example, which newspapers in this country keep having to run corrections on. You know, they keep asserting it and then having to take it back, or Iran's unique involvement in regional wars, for example. These things kind of lay there like tools waiting to be picked up as long as media don't really interrogate them to the root.
Absolutely. And I think so. One of them that are very, very common is the idea that the Iranians are the only ones pursuing a policy in the region that has an interventionist character to it. That clearly describes almost every country in the region. That is not to give the Iranians a pass for what they're doing, but the singular focus on them actually reveals more of our unwillingness to realize and recognize and tell our public that this is actually a problem that not only is shared by everyone in the region, but the United States itself has actually been playing a significant role in this. Whatever the Iranians have done to destabilize the region, it does not in any way, shape, or form come anywhere near the destabilizing effect that the Iraq War has had on the region as a whole. That is the most destabilizing event of the past 25 years in the Middle East. And that was not Iran, that was the United States.
Well, let me just ask you finally about media. You know, I'm not sure how much foreign policy relies on public opinion. I think that relationship is indirect, to be generous. But I do think media are very powerful in telling us, for example, that Iran is one thing, you know, without further breakdown or elaboration, and then that U.S. interests in Iran somehow means something that the U.S. public is going to benefit from. And I just wonder what you would like to see journalists. It's not that they're not going to be covering it. We're probably going to be seeing stories pretty much every day. What would you like to see journalists doing more of or less of, perhaps, as we go forward in this very delicate and dangerous conversation between the U.S. and Iran?
Well, one thing I would very much like to see is that we do hear oftentimes that allies of the United States in the region would like to see the United States intervene here or intervene there. Right now, the Israelis and the Saudis have been pushing very hard for a very, very tough line against Iran. They would like to see the United States to do something that would shift the balance of power in the region away from Iran and towards Saudi Arabia and Israel. If you are sitting in Riyadh, if you're sitting in Tel Aviv, I understand why that is attractive to you. I understand why you would think that that lies in your national interest. What I don't understand is that media doesn't ask the question, okay, how does this lie in America's national interest? And actually have a conversation about this rather than automatically assuming that whatever the Saudis or the Israelis or other U.S. allies in the region want automatically means that that is also compatible with U.S. interests.
We've been speaking with Trita Parsi, founder and president of the National Iranian American Council. You can find them online at niacouncil.org. Trita Parsi, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you so much for having me.
An important article in the American Journalism Review, headlined "Missing the Story at the State House," posed a troubling question. State governments are doing more than ever, so why are newspapers paying less attention? The piece ends with a Georgia reporter recalling an epiphany she had entering the state's House of Representatives. "I walked around the velvet rope and it dawned on me," said Lawrence Veal. "This is the cutoff point. We are it between the lobbyists clogging the hallways and the public policymakers. Especially as money continues to more and more affect the process, it's even more important that we are here." That article dates from 1998. As local newspapers continue to suffer not just cutbacks but closures, you'd think the question still more urgent. But what about claims that local papers have lost their relevance anyway, making their disappearance a merely sentimental loss? Research by our next guest may be read as at least partial response to that. Dermot Murphy is Assistant Professor of Finance at the University of Illinois at Chicago and co-author with Paul Gao and Chang Li of the report Financing Dies in Darkness: The Impact of Newspaper Closures on Public Finance. He joins us now by phone from Chicago. Welcome to Counterspin, Dermot Murphy.
Hi, thanks for having me on the program.
Well, this is, if I may say, a dry-eyed research paper. It looks at quantifiable things and measurable effects, but it's nevertheless meaningful with regard to very human concerns, impacts on real people, on representational government, and on community. Let me just ask you first, what was your guiding question as you designed the project? What in broad terms were you hoping to shine a light on?
Well, broadly speaking, we thought that if a newspaper closes in a local area, then it's going to have a major effect on the important watchdog role that's played by the media for monitoring local governments. And we suspected if local governments are no longer being monitored, then they're more likely to engage in bad behavior. And when they're more likely to engage in bad behavior, then lenders become a little bit more nervous about lending to such a government, and they have to demand higher interest rates to compensate for that risk. And we do indeed find that in the data, that interest rates are higher after a newspaper closes because of these increased government inefficiencies. And that ultimately costs the taxpayer money in the long run.
Well, it's very interesting. The paper opens by citing some other research showing how declines in local coverage are associated with that lack of accountability. And it also has a particular electoral impact, doesn't it, as well?
It indeed does. We looked at the political economy literature, and we did see that there were a variety of negative political outcomes that resulted from the closure of a local newspaper, such as lower voter turnout, more apathetic politicians, and so on. But we as finance professors decided to look at this from a finance angle, and we do indeed see through quantifiable evidence that a newspaper closure does indeed lead to higher costs for local governments. So it's harder to raise money to finance public works projects such as schools, hospitals, and roadways.
Well, we always hear correlation is not causality. You know, ice cream sales don't drive the temperature up. What if both these newspaper closures and these increased costs are both due to some third force? You considered that.
Yeah, and that's an excellent question. And this is a major challenge in finance and economics research in general. So we have a multi-pronged approach for addressing this correlation versus causation issue, because it could indeed be the case that an economically depressed area will lead to both higher borrowing costs and the closure of a local newspaper. But in one of our first tests, we actually look at the nearest neighbor. So we identify a county that did experience a newspaper closure, and then we looked at a neighboring county that was matched on population and economic characteristics that has its own newspaper operation. And we do indeed find that borrowing costs go up for the treatment county, as in the county that experienced the newspaper closure, but not the neighboring county that still has a newspaper. So that's one of our approaches.
Well, and then another question, which we often hear even just as media critics when we talk about the importance of local newspapers, but we have the internet. You know, this is an old kind of media that people don't really engage with anymore. You also looked at the idea of substitutability, that other media could play that role that local newspapers play.
Yeah, coming into the project, we thought, okay, the alternative hypothesis is that borrowing costs would not be affected by a newspaper closure because other sources of media would fill the vacuum created by the local newspaper closure, particularly the internet. But that doesn't really bear out in the data. We find that the borrowing costs do indeed increase. So that suggests to us that the internet is not necessarily filling the gap left by the newspaper closure, at least for the time being.
Well, let me just bring you out a little bit more on this financial impact. Why should regular folks care when the borrowing costs of their government go up? What are some of the impacts of that?
Well, if the borrowing costs go up, then governments have more trouble borrowing money to fund important public works projects such as schools and hospitals. And so we looked and saw that for the average municipal loan, this increased the interest rates that you have to pay altogether by about $650,000 per loan. So this is a lower bound estimate, of course, because municipality needs to take out many loans over time. And it's also the case that if the newspaper coverage problem continues to worsen, then we can see the borrowing costs going up even further. And so to add to this a little bit more, we also look at the taxes being charged per person after a newspaper closure due to government inefficiencies. And we do find that the taxes per person increased by about $85 per person per year after a newspaper closure. So this is pretty substantial from a taxpayer point of view, and it highlights the importance of local investigative reporting.
Absolutely. And, you know, of course, as a critic, I sometimes feel that local papers fall short. Sometimes they're caught up with local powers, but their existence itself seems to matter very much, in addition to the quality and hard-hitting investigative reporting that they sometimes do. It seems like just having them there is important. I was talking with Corey Hutchins, a Colorado reporter, about the Denver Post problems, and he told a story about how a lawmaker there was asked, you know, what do you think about these problems at the Post? And they joked, well, I guess we'll be able to get away with whatever we want to now, you know? And that seems to be at the heart of the work that you're doing here, even though it's about numbers and financial information, it still comes back to that accountability.
Yes, that's indeed the case. And I've actually heard that quote before from a different reporter. And I thought to myself, well, okay, this is obviously a joke, but there's a lot of truth behind that joke. So I think it's the sort of thing we should take very seriously.
Absolutely. Well, I'll just ask you finally, for a piece of research that's not really widely published, it seems to have made rather more of a splash than your average financial research paper. What were you hoping the response would be? And do you have other work planned in this vein?
You know, we were expecting a positive response from the journalism community, but we didn't expect this kind of response. So we're very happy that we're getting the message out about the importance of newspapers and local journalism for keeping costs down. So it's really good to get that message out there, especially in this day and age when things have become a little more politically divided, because I think our argument should even appeal to fiscal conservatives, because we say that, you know, a local newspaper does help to keep government costs down.
We've been speaking with Dermot Murphy, Assistant Professor of Finance at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Dermot Murphy, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Yeah, thanks very much.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.